Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. We can take a firefighter's ultimate duty off the back burner today to give it one last chance to burn. I know I have been running amok with all of these fire puns, but I mean, come on, they're right there. I can't help it. And at the end of things, I really did like this book. So while suspense is not my favorite genre, I do have a favorite suspense author, and that would be Dean Koontz. I admittedly have not been up to date on his latest works. I kind of got burned out a couple years ago, but I'm thinking that I might want to get back into him. But anyway, I like his writing because a lot of his suspense includes supernatural elements, because, you know, what can I say? I like to escape from reality when I'm reading. I want to see a more supernatural occurrence or elements creeping in. Like, I like the urban fantasy look. So I look out for those reality escaping books, and Dean Koontz really fits that bill. Now, getting back to A Firefighter's Ultimate Duty, in this book, while there's no strange goings on, I feel like the suspense was well balanced with the romance. And the romance was actually believable. So when we're looking at The Negotiator, for instance, they were just basically mashing their faces. But with here, even though there was a little bit of spark of something at play between our two leads, I didn't really feel that it was beyond any normal bounds. Because, hey, sometimes love at first sight can happen, but it wasn't so explosive here that it was distracting. I do want to talk a little bit about something that has popped up in this novel. Something that I see in a lot of the blurbs on the romance books is an inclusion of a single parent and their children. And one of the reasons I was interested in this one was because both the heroes were single parents. But I wonder if the bigger trend of the single parent in these stories, I wonder if that speaks to the larger demographic that reads Harlequins in general. If you go into the bookstore and you look at the special edition groups, those are very much like ranching, down home, lot of single parentage. But it's not just there. All of the books, all of the genres, all of their imprints, they all have some kind of version of single parentage in a lot of them. And I'm not an expert at all in what the Harlequin demographics look like. I don't know what their analytics are, but it kind of really makes me curious. I want to see if this is a driving factor of the types of books that are written and selected to be published with Harlequin. I really do want to dig my teeth into some exploration on that fact. For my personal interpretation as to why the teenagers were added into this story is that they add to the danger that is presented to Daisy Rambler. So if you remember, Daisy is on the run from her stalker ex-fiancé. I will say that the story mentioned that he didn't have a lot of interest in Sophie. It was pretty obvious that Jacob was just not interested at all in connecting with Sophie, or at least he didn't present that he was interested. I find that really interesting because Jacob did pretty much everything he could to enchant Daisy, and I'm surprised that he didn't add Sophie into that mix. When he kidnapped Daisy, and he was telling her, "You're going to be giving me more children," she says, "You need to tell me if Sophie's okay, because I'm not giving you any babies. If Sophie's not okay, I couldn't do it." And with that in mind, Jacob is presented as the sort of person who would use Sophie as a method to control Daisy. He tells her what she wants to hear, but Daisy doesn't really get any information on whether or not Sophie is actually okay. When I was reading the book, I could not help but feel that something bad would happen to Sophie, or that she and Raven would be involved in the conflict, and it looks like my gut feeling was correct. Now, for why Blade was given a daughter, because, you know, he's not the one running from a stalker, I believe that it proves that Blade is a safe partner for Daisy. Now, for us as readers, we have more information than the characters do, so long as the author wants to give it to us. So we get to watch Blade in both his roles as a firefighter and a father. So while Daisy might not be able to see everything good about him right off the bat, we do. For Daisy, she is scared, she's running from Jacob, she doesn't want to trust anybody, least of all a man. And in order for her to be able to warm up to Blade, we have to be warmed up to Blade. Otherwise, we're like, no, girl, don't do it, run. Raven exists to show us that Blade is safe. And we are proven without a shadow of a doubt that he is a safe partner, especially considering what she was running from. Now, as far as Blade's relationships go, we're told that his first wife couldn't handle his firefighter hours, and I would probably also guess that she couldn't handle the pressure of the dangers that came with his job, so she ended up having an affair. And Blade didn't even blame her for it. From what I understood in the novel, everyone was like, why do you treat your ex so nicely? She cheated on you. Like, what the heck? And Blade's like, I get it. It's like, he totally understood why it happened. It's like, you know, it is what it is. It almost kind of reminds me, like, if you've ever watched Grey's Anatomy, a lot of those relationships are like, oh my gosh, you're always at the hospital. You don't have any time for our relationship. And like, you knew they were a doctor going in. You knew what they were doing. Of course they're busy. I just find it a little interesting. But now Daisy gets to come along, and she is basically Velcroed to his side against her will, just for the sake of the fundraiser. And so she gets a first-hand look about what his job entails. So now she gets to know exactly what she'll be getting into should she decide to start something with Blade, if at all. Now, I do know that I give our romantic heroes a lot of flack, but I have to. My standards are high. I am looking at everything. I'm looking at the level of consent. I am looking at their communication. I am looking at whether or not they are taking their partner's needs into account. Are they connecting as, you know, people? So even seemingly perfect Blade trips up a little bit when he gets Daisy's address from his cop friend, instead of following the usual lost and found procedures. I mentioned a little bit of this in the podcast, but I want to get a little bit deeper into it. I find it really odd that this is framed as an appropriate action for Blade, especially when he's paired against the stalker plotline. It's really interesting because, like I said, Blade is shown to us to be a safe partner. However, that safe partner is now kind of doing something that's a little stalkery and it's a little concerning. When we look at someone with Daisy's past, she's running from a horrible, horrible man, and he has done everything within his power to know about her location and her whereabouts and what she's doing and when she's doing it. And Blade, while it's not a full stalker action, he's still getting her information from a person who has high authority and is trusted implicitly in the community, and he's going to use that information to go see Daisy. So if Blade does something weird, knowing what we know about cops sometimes, Marcus may not do anything about Blade's behavior. Of course, this was proven incorrect in the middle of the novel, when Blade's like, oh my gosh, your house has been broken into. Of course you're going to be staying with me. And Marcus is like, dude, you need to back off and chill out. So we can kind of see a little bit that Marcus has got a good head on his shoulders too. But in a different situation, this could go really, really badly. So speaking of Marcus, I'm starting to wonder if I should follow the Heroes of the Pacific Northwest series as they come out. From what I understand, as far as we know, there's going to be 3 books. The first one is obviously Blade. The next one is Marcus the Cop. And then the third one after that is Jamie the Doctor. I've been kind of considering it when I pick up an interesting series. We already know that we've seen a couple of books that are in the middle of the series, but I've also gotten a couple from the beginning. You might all remember how I gushed over A Wolf in Duke's Clothing in episode 5, and I know I'm going to be following that series for sure. I am waiting for the next book. It is should be coming out at the end of December. I hope that it keeps that way. Another book that I've been waiting on has been pushed back a week because of, well, everything, shipping including. I'm waiting for it. I'm probably going to have that on order as soon as I humanly possibly can. And I think I might want to follow this series with Blade and the other Pacific Northwest boys. Even though that I'm unhappy with the editing job, I rather like the small town of Nowhere, and I'm really curious to see what happens to Blade's friends. With Marcus, he's going to be the next one, and that's interesting because in the book he has been presented as not quite a womanizer. He respects women. He's drinking his respect women juice. We saw evidence of that when he told Blade to back up. But he has a lot of lady friends. He loves the ladies. So it might be interesting to see if there's actually a woman who could quote unquote tame him. Oh, that's a terrible phrase of words, but hey, what else are we going to use for romance, right? I'm especially curious about Jamie though, since he's both a doctor and a pilot. I'm more interested in the pilot aspect, but reasons for that are for another time on another podcast. But it looks like Marcus's story is up first, and that's due out in February next year. And then, of course, there's the long-running series that I find and fall into. If we remember She Dreamed of a Cowboy, there were 14 of those books. I'm really curious. Well, and also, thanks to the nature of the Harlequin romance, I can really just jump into any novel, so it's not like I'm missing anything. So if I really like one book from a series, should I get the others and start to maybe make it a long feature with the occasional episodes going back to that author? Just a few questions that I've been ruminating over. There was another book by Beverly Long that really caught my eye, and I'm like, oh, do I want to go right into the same author, even though there are so many more to read? That's the thing about Harlequin, is there are so many of these, so it's hard to justify a repeat author so soon, you know? It's just questions that I've been really thinking about. And for now, I think we will leave the town of Nowhere until we get called back, because it's time to see what I have been reading this week. And, well, you've caught me. I am still stuck with The Heralds of Haldemar by Mercedes Lackey. I just haven't been able to get away from her for some reason. Maybe I just need the Heralds right now, like I need comfort food. It's the beginning of fall, time for nostalgia and good feelings. My choice in particular right now is Take a Thief. It's the third in the pseudo-trilogy that features Harold Albrecht, but this one focuses more on Skiff. He's a young boy who becomes a thief to survive. And one day, he sees a white horse unattended, and he goes to steal it, but whoops! That is not a horse, and now he's a herald. But I won't get too deep into this, because I've already talked about Mercedes Lackey a lot. So instead, why don't I tell you about some of my favorite Dean Koontz books? It's Halloween season, after all. Why not enjoy some spooky suspense? The first one that I will tell you about was my introduction to Dean Koontz as an author, way back in high school, all those years ago. Odd Thomas. I can vividly remember walking to my school library and seeing on display a gray gradient cover with a ghostly pair of legs walking towards the reader. They say not to judge a book by its cover, but I was captivated by that image. I checked it out, and the rest was history. Odd Story, yes, that is his actual name, is twisted in mystery and sadness. He can see the dead, all in varying states depending on how they died. He sees a lot of different types of folks. There's one guy who hangs out at a tire center who has a dismembered arm, and he just kind of sits at the tire store waving his dismembered arm at Odd Thomas as he walks by. A lot of the ghosts do know that he can see them. And this guy died in a car crash, and he's just kind of hanging around because he doesn't want to keep moving on. He thinks that maybe the tires had something to do with this car crash, which is not true. Another ghostly apparition that hangs out with him is Elvis, the king himself. The king is unusual for among the ghosts because he is the only ghost that Odd can think of that can change his appearance. Depending on Elvis's mood, he will appear in performance uniforms or movie costumes. No matter what, Elvis usually has let's say an outfit for the occasion. He is there as sort of like a spiritual guide for Tom or for Odd, and in some ways, kind of a friend in a way. And Odd is there to, like, you know, help him pass on, you know, eventually. He's there, and it's really funny. It's really cute. Odd actually has a friend who is a huge Elvis fan, and she always tells Odd, like, when you borrow my car, you can't let any of the ghosts ride in it, except Elvis. Elvis is fine. But Odd and his girlfriend Stormy go on to thwart a plot that will plunge his small California town into chaos and death. It's got a lot of really interesting themes and some interesting apparitions, I guess you could say. I have dutifully bought every single novel in the Odd Thomas series. There are 8 novels and 3 graphic novels. The latter is taking place before the series begins proper. Now, for my personal tastes, the first 3 books are my absolute favorite of the series: Odd Thomas, Forever Odd, and Brother Odd. All of these 3 have wildly bizarre villains, and they're all different in their own ways, and they all somehow skirt the line of fantasy and reality. But after that, even though I've read the entire series, I could not tell you what happens in the second half of the books. They didn't imprint themselves on my mind the way the first 3 did. The 4th is borderline. As it's the season of horror, and Odd Thomas is as close to horror as I am comfortable getting in a general setting, I think I might settle back down with the series and give the second half another go. It also doesn't help that the books have committed the worst of the sins. I don't know why his publishing house did this. They changed the covers. And halfway through the series, they changed the covers. I hate it. Don't do that. Anyway, next up is life expectancy. This one is a hard one to summarize because it is an adventure from start to finish. The bare-bones explanation is that on the day that Jimmy Talk is born, his grandfather makes a deathbed prediction of 5 terrible days in Jimmy's life. It is a twisted story, characters wrapped around one another in inexplicable ways. I'm not going to say anything else on it, because the less you know about it, the better you go get it. Go read it. It's great. Now, my final suggestion is kind of an interesting one: The Darkest Evening of the Year. Any fan of Kuntz will know his deep love of golden retrievers. Published after the death of his golden retriever Trixie, I would say that it's a love letter to her and to all goldens in the world. So the book follows Amy Redwing and her boyfriend Brian, beginning with an insane rescue of a special golden retriever named Nikki. Amy has some dark ghosts in her past, and they all come out to find her once more after Nikki's rescue. Now, I don't think he wrote the book after Trixie's passing, he didn't write it before Trixie had passed away, but it is clear that she had a deep influence on the story. If you like suspense, and you like dogs, this is one that you'd want to check out. And I'm going to tell you now, the dogs all live. So those are my 3 recommends that I would give you to direct you to Dean Kuntz. I definitely would say that he's got a lot to say about society in general in some ways, but he doesn't really shove it down your throats in the choices that I have presented with you. I really, really think that he is a fascinating author. He seems completely normal. It's like, it's so weird. Like, all these super twisted suspense horror writers seem totally normal on the outside. But he's also one of those writers who just pumps book out one after another, just keeps going. But I don't think his quality suffers for that. Some of it gets a little out there, especially with The Darkest Evening of the Year. That one's kind of out there. But I really think he's a really, really cool writer. And I mean, I wouldn't have him on my shelf if I didn't like him. So with that, I will leave it for today. I hope to see you again next week when we read His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation by Maisie Yates here at Hopelessly Romantic. So thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. Our show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an Age with K production. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.